All right, so let's pick up where we left off last week. This is a part two of what we started speaking about last week. I'll recap last week briefly, and then we'll see where tonight takes us. We spoke last week about the concept of the centrality of the Karban HaOmer to the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. We usually think of the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer as just a mitzvah to count. But one thing that becomes very clear when going through a number of different sources is that it's not just a mitzvah to count, it's a mitzvah to count which is connected to and triggered by the Karban HaOmer, the special sacrifice that in the Beis HaMikdash was brought on the second day of Pesach. It was a sacrifice that was brought from the first crop of barley. It was ground up and brought as flour. It was an omer's worth of flour. The omer is the name of a measurement, hence the name of that particular carbon being the carbon of the omer. And we know that this whole period, the counting of the omer, took its name from that particular carbon. Parenthetically, this is something I didn't mention last week, but for those who are careful about the idea of Yashon, this Karban HaOmer was a major, major event. Because basically what the Karban HaOmer allowed, as it says in the Chumash, is that any grain which had been grown from the prior year, you know, any grain that had been grown during the winter, could not be eaten until after the Karban HaOmer was brought. In a sense, the Karban HaOmer functioned as a type of bikurim, like a first fruits kind of karban. The same way that you know, you would bring your first fruits to Hashem, you know, as a statement that I'm not going to touch anything until I first acknowledge what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has done for me, so too the new grain would not be consumed until the Karban HaOmer was brought and allowed that chadosh meaning new, that the new grain would be only acceptable after the Karban HaOmer was brought. Until the Karban HaOmer was brought, you could only have Yashon, old grain, you know, that had sprouted from at least, you know, the previous Pesach. You know, as we know, if you go into many pizza stores today, or bakeries, or you buy many baked products, they oftentimes say on them, Yashon. And sometimes people wonder, you know, if that's true, why would they want to advertise that, you know? I mean, why would you want to buy cake that's old? That would seem to bring down the price a little bit. So, what's really being advertised is the following idea. There is a dispute among Poskim whether these laws of Chadash and Yashan apply only in Eretz Yisrael. Everybody agrees that they apply in Eretz Yisrael. That's beyond question. But there is some question as to whether they apply outside of Eretz Yisrael as well. Are they like the rest of the mitzvahs, like Trumos and Maaseros and the like, you know, the different tithes, which are only taken off in the land of Israel? Or no, are the laws of Chadosh and Yashon universal in scope? The common practice, certainly among Ashkenazim, for many years, was to assume that, you know, that they only apply in Eretz Yisrael, not outside of Eretz Yisrael, but many have accepted the stricture, the chumrah of being careful about Yashon and Chadosh, even in Chusala Aretz, and hence, you know, that's why these products are labeled as such. If somebody tells you now, however, you know, what is it? We're exactly 24 days after the second day of Pesach tonight. If somebody tells you now that I can't have that cookie because I'm acted on Yashon, you know they don't know what they're talking about, because at this point, you know, after Pesach has just passed, unless somebody has managed miraculously to grow wheat, you know, since Pesach, grind it up into flour and make cookies out of it, you know, if he can do that, so then you should talk to him about more things, about just whether he's mastered on Yashon or the like. You know, this time of year is not really an issue. For those who are careful about Yashon, it's only really around Rosh Hashanah time that people have to start worrying about whether these particular cookies or cakes or whatnot, or breads, you know, are indeed Yashon or not. Okay. So we spoke about this, and again, coming back to the main point, we spoke about the centrality of the Karban HaOmer, and how, according to really the vast majority of authorities, the mitzvah to count Sfira only applies when you bring the Karban HaOmer. The mitzvah is triggered by bringing the Karban HaOmer, and it's only, Miyom Aviachem is Alma HaTnufa. As the Pasuk says, you should count from the second day of Pesach, from the day on which you bring the Karbon HaOmer. If there's a Karbon, there's counting. If there's no Karbon, so at least according to Torah law, there is no counting. And for that reason, the truth is the vast majority of rabbinic authorities hold that the mitzvah to count Sfiras HaOmer nowadays is a rabbinic mitzvah. It's a din derabbanan. It's a reminder of the Torah mitzvah that existed once upon a time, but right now it's not the real deal, so to speak. It's a rabbinic pale reflection of what was once a Torah mitzvah. We said that's why immediately after counting Sfira, the custom is to say Harachman Hu Yachzir Lanu Avodas Beis Hamikdash L'Mkama, that the Ribbono Shel Olam should restore the Beis Hamikdash and its service to us speedily. Yeah, that's something we always hope for. Why do we say it specifically after Sfira? Answer, because essentially our mitzvah Sfira Sa'omer is somewhat incomplete in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. So we're asking the Ribbono Shel Olam, look, we did the rabbinic mitzvah because that's all we've got. Ribbono Shel Olam, bring back the Torah mitzvah so that we can perform the mitzvah in the best proper fashion, you know, according to Torah law. Yeah, that's a kind of summary of what we spoke about last week. The hashkafic, or the philosophical question, which we raised last week briefly, and which I'd like to try to talk a little bit more about tonight, is why that should be so. Let me just even preface the question with a little bit of background. Why do we count the days between Pesach and Shavuos? So the most common answer, which I think is articulated best by the Sefer HaChinuch, but, you know, it's the common answer that if you ask, you know, 4 out of 5 people will give you this particular answer. The answer that's traditionally given is that when we left Mitzrayim, when we left Egypt, as we commemorate every year on Pesach, we're only really partially free. We're free in a physical sense, but our true spiritual freedom is only going to be achieved when Shavuos comes and we get the Torah. There is an integral connection between Pesach and Shavuos. Shavuos, in a sense, is the culmination of the holiday of Pesach. So to accentuate that link between Pesach and Shavuos, to show that once we're out of Mitzrayim, we're looking forward expectantly and anxiously to the culmination, the finish, you know, the completion of everything that Pesach represents, we anxiously count until we're going to get to Shavuos. Just 2 things to add to that idea. The Ramban, in his commentary on Chumash, has a fascinating description of the period of Sfiras HaOmer. He calls it Chol HaMoed. Chol HaMoed? So you mean we should go on trips to the zoo every day during Sfiras HaOmer? Well, it's Chol HaMoed in the following sense. What's Chol HaMoed? If you think about Chol HaMoed or Pesach or Sukkot, Chol HaMoed is the bridge between the Yom Tov which begins the holiday and the Yom Tov which ends the holiday. So too, says the Ramban, in a sense, Pesach isn't over until Shavuos. I mean, fortunately, we can have chametz, you know, long before Shavuos. Can you imagine, you know, 50 days of, you know, of, I mean, Oberlander's cookies are nice and everything, but, you know, 50 days of it, I think, would be a little bit excessive, right? But, you know, we only observe Pesach in the strict sense of the term for 7 or 8 days, depending on where we are. But in a certain conceptual sense, you know, the idea of Pesach, the Yom Tov of Pesach, is not fully over, it's not fully achieved, until we get to Shavuos. So, in a sense, as the Ramban says, this period of Sfiras HaOmer is the Chol HaMoed between the Yom Tov of Pesach at one end and the Yom Tov of Shavuos on the other end. That's why, explain many commentators, the rabbis in the Talmud never talk about Shavuos as being Shavuos. In the Talmud, Shavuos is always referred to as Atzeres. Now, Atzeres is a word which does appear in Chumash. Atzeres is used to describe the last day of Pesach. Atzeres, as we know more famously, is also used to describe Shmini Atzeres. What is the word Atzeres? So Atzeres, as you can tell from both, right, is Atzeres connotes the finale, the end of a long period of holiday. Right? So in other words, that's why it applies to Shmini Atzeres. Shmini Atzeres is the wrap, you know, the cleanup day, so to speak, the wrapping up of Sukkot, and even more broadly, the whole Tishrei period, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, finally, Shmini Atzeres, you know, the last day where you kind of sum up everything that you've done up until that point. The last day of Pesach is also the Atzeres of Pesach. Chazal referred to Shavuos constantly throughout the Gemara as Atzeres because it's the wrap-up holiday. It's the holiday which wraps up and completes the whole period of Pesach and the Sfiras HaOmer. So again, there's this tremendous connection between Pesach and Shavuos, which is accentuated by the Sfira. Okay, given that that's so, why should that be dependent on the Karpa? Why isn't that concept of Sfiras HaOmer, of counting every day so as to link Pesach and Shavuos, something that can apply for all generations, regardless of whether or not there's a Karbon of the Omer? Why should the fact that they bring the Karbon HaOmer on the second day of Pesach have any bearing whatsoever, hashkafically, you know, philosophically? Why should that have any bearing on whether or not there's a mitzvah to count the days between Pesach and Shavuos? Pesach and Shavuos represent, even nowadays, in the absence of the Karbon, Pesach and Shavuos represent our physical freedom and our spiritual elevation that we achieve through the Kabbalah Satara, the acceptance of the Torah. Why should the presence or absence of the Karbon have any bearing on whether or not the mitzvah of Sfira is a Torah mitzvah or a rabbinic mitzvah? Granted that they're linked, why would the Torah link them in such a way? So I think that's what we're going to try to talk about tonight, to try to answer that question. Why should there be this linkage, philosophically, between the Karbon on the one hand and the mitzvah to count Sfira? So I'd like to suggest the following. And again, I think it gives us a little bit of a different perspective on a lot of things that we know already, but maybe we'll look at them a little bit differently. Why do we start counting Sfira from the second day Pesach? In other words, if the point is to link Pesach and Shavuos, if it was up to me, I would do that in one of two ways. I would either start counting from the first day of Pesach, or I would count from the last day of Pesach. Isn't it a little odd to count from the second day of Pesach? So the Sefer HaChinuch asks this question. The Sefer HaChinuch suggests that, you know what, we can't count from the first day of Pesach, because on the first day of Pesach we're so focused on the miracle of getting out of Egypt, we don't want to make that first day of Pesach too complicated. Again, remember, it becomes a little bit more complicated in Chutz La'aretz because we keep the second day of Pesach as if it was the first day of Pesach, and we also start counting Sfira, so we actually do kind of mix all of them together. But, you know, speaking from the point of view of Eretz Yisrael, the way that things are really supposed to be, so the first day of Pesach is all about the Seder, and Matzah, and Maror, and commemorating Yetzias Mitzrayim. Then we finish with that, and now, you know, we'll turn our attention to the next project, you know, Sfira Sa'omer, that starts on the second day. Sefer HaChinuch says, it's very pragmatic, we just don't want to mix together, you know, these two ideas. You try to put too much, you ever try to plan a program, you know, we're going to have seven speakers, a couple of songs, and, a few national anthems here and there. That's the best way to kill a program, you know, to overstuff it with too much activity. So too, you know, the Torah didn't want to overstuff the first day of Pesach with too much going on, so we do with first off the first day of Pesach, and then Sfira begins from the second day. I'd like to suggest something that's a little bit different, but maybe you could stick it into the words of the Sefer HaChinuch as well. I'd like to suggest that there's a fundamentally different theme between the first day of Pesach and the second day of Pesach. And that the theme of second day Pesach relates to Sfira in a way the first really doesn't. The first day of Pesach commemorates miracles that are supernatural. Right? The experience that we had when HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Mitzrayim was God acting me'al lateva in a supernatural way that went beyond the forces of nature. Right? Everything that God did in taking us out of Egypt was super miraculous. Right? From the fact that all of the firstborn in Egypt died at precisely the same moment, right? The tremendous speed with which Klal Yisrael were able to make their way out of Egypt, ultimately the events, this didn't happen the first day of Pesach, but the events of Kriyas Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, tremendous, tremendous miracle. Everything that's associated with Yetzias Mitzrayim was super duper miraculous. It went far beyond the teva. It went far beyond the confines of the natural world. For future generations, that first day of Pesach is always linked to an appreciation of God in the supernatural and the miraculous. There are numerous events which are, you know, by tradition, we understand happened on the first day of Pesach in later history, and they're all incredibly miraculous, supernatural events. Just to take one example, the Navi tells us that after conquering the 10 northern tribes, Sancheriv, the king of Assyria, marched on Yerushalayim, surrounded it with a tremendous army, and basically told the Jews, look, there isn't even a contest over here. We read on the eighth day of Pesach, the Haftarah from Yeshaya, where it says that Sancheriv came to Nov, a town, you know, that's not far from Yerushalayim. And you know, Faith Yodo Harbas Siyam, the Navi describes very poetically how Sancheriv looked down at Yerushalayim from the mountains of Nov, and he waves his hand dismissively. He says, ah, that's a city. There's nothing. You know, I've conquered much bigger cities than Yerushalayim. I can take them down in a minute. It's not even worth talking about. And what happens? Sancheriv and his armies are encamped around Yerushalayim. All of a sudden, you know, in the middle of the night, as the Navi puts it, the Maluch of Hashem comes down from Shamayim, takes out the entire army, thousands of soldiers. They all drop dead in the middle of the night. The Jews wake up in the morning, they see the Assyrian army is decimated. Right? The tradition has it that that miracle, and it's a miracle, there's no way to explain it in natural terms, that miracle happens on the first night of Pesach. The first night of Pesach, Leil Shimurim, the night of divine protection, it's a night, it's a day on which we appreciate the role that HaKadosh Baruch Hu plays in dealing with us in a supernatural fashion. I'd like to suggest that when we move over to the second day Pesach, the theme of the second day Pesach is very different. The theme of the second day Pesach is appreciating God in everyday life, in nature, in the mundane. Right? Not in the miraculous, the supernatural, God makes an army drop dead, God, you know, causes every Bukhar and Mitzrayim to die, God takes us out, Al Kanfei Nisharim on eagle's wings. No. None of that humdrum, ordinary, regular, simple, you know, no tremendous, obvious miracles. The miracles that the second day Pesach celebrates are the miracles of everyday life. That's the Karban HaOmer. The Karban HaOmer is an expression of thanks to the Ribbono Shel Olam for giving us a barley harvest, right? For helping the crops grow. Now you say, okay, the crops grow every year. Yeah, but that's a miracle. The fact that it happens every year doesn't make it any less of a miracle. It makes it more of a miracle. It's an ongoing miracle. The nature itself is the most tremendous miracle, right? We can only appreciating Hashem in the supernatural, which is the first day of Pesach, is only really relevant, is only really translatable into everyday life. It's only worth something in a certain sense if after we appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in the supernatural, we then turn around and say, oh, not only does Hashem make tremendous nisim in a supernatural fashion, He make, you know, Nisecha Shebuchol Yom Imanu, you make miracles that are with us on a daily basis, on a regular basis. If you look in the historically in the various events that are associated with the second day Pesach, you see this theme running through again and again. The Navi tells us in Sefer Shoftim that one of the leaders of the Jewish people, one of the Shoftim, was a man by the name of Gidon. Gidon had a war going on with the people of Midian, a foreign country that was waging war against the Jewish people. And Gidon's army was far outnumbered by the Midianim. Right? I mean, in a military sense, there was nothing to talk about. The Midianim were clearly going to be the victors. So the Midianim have, you know, mobilized their camp, and Gidon is trying to figure out what to do. He sends down spies to the Midiani camp to try to get a sense and get a read on what these people are all about. So his spies go down, and they hear two Midiani guards talking to one another. So I'll describe the Sefer Shoftim. One Midiani guard says to the other one, So, it's a funny thing. I had the weirdest dream last night. He says, yeah, what's your dream about? He says, I can't really explain it. I saw this incredible mound of barley that came rolling through the camp and destroyed the whole camp. And then I woke up. What do you think that means? I don't know. It's a very strange dream. So the spy, the Jewish spy, hears this whole conversation, goes back to Gidon. Gidon says, they're dreaming about barley destroying their camp. That's a sign that we should attack. He gets together the few hundred men that he has. He gives everybody a shofar and an earthenware vessel. They come down to close to the Midiani camp. They all break the earthenware vessels. They blow the shofros. The Midianim are incredibly surprised by what's going on. They think that thousands of soldiers are attacking them. They hear all these breaking sounds. They hear all these shofars being blown. They think, wow, the world is coming to an end. They pick up, they flee. And the Jews are victorious. They defeat the Midianim. Say Chazal, when did that battle take place? Second day Pesach. What was the barley in the dream? It was the Karban HaOmer. That these Midianim had this vision of the Karban HaOmer coming and destroying their camp. When Gidon heard that, and he knew it was the second day of Pesach, he said, okay, that's not just a dream. That's a siman min hashamayim, that's a sign from heaven that I'm destined to come in and destroy this Midiani army. Now, if you think about that victory can be explained in pure military terms. In other words, if you were not a believer and you heard that story, you would say Gidon was a brilliant strategist. It happens to be a brilliant strategy. They have thousands of soldiers. You have a couple of hundred soldiers. So get them to think you have a couple of thousand soldiers. I mean, it was risky, but it paid off big time. But you could look at that whole event and just say, that was just brilliant. He was a brilliant strategist, Gidon. You can explain everything that happened in totally mundane, natural terms. In contrast, they tell the story, I don't know whether it's apocryphal or not, but they tell the story that, I don't know whether it's cadets at West Point, at one of the military academies, they were studying various different wars, and the subject came up about Israel's victory in the 67 war, the Six-Day War. And one of the cadets asked, why don't we study this war? The Israelis had this lightning victory against all the Arab armies. Why don't we, analyze how they did it and try to understand it? And supposedly the instructor answered, because this war breaks all the rules. There's nothing we can learn from this war. They only could have won by virtue of a miracle. There is no natural explanation for the fact that the Israelis won in the way in which they did in 1967. That war breaks all the rules. It doesn't make sense to use that as a textbook war, to try to analyze, what our strategy should be like, because it's in a category by itself, right? Again, that's supposedly the story that they tell. In contrast, Gidon's war sounds like a West Point cadet might have studied, this was a brilliant strategy that Gidon used. Again, it's the victory, obviously HaKadosh Baruch Hu is behind every victory, but it's the victory not of the first day Pesach, it's the victory of the second day Pesach, a victory in Teva, in the natural way of, dealing with a problem, not in a supernatural fashion. Another event tied to the second day Pesach. There's a minhag that's brought in Svarim, that by the second day Pesach, by the meal, to sing Shoshanas Yaakov. So you say Shoshanas Yaakov, that's a Purim song. Mm-hmm. Those four cups of wine that you had the night before really seemed to have worked very well. I mean, Adelo Yoda, right? It adds a new dimension to Adelo Yoda.
When Haman started to fall.
Right. No, so Haman was hanged. More than started, he started to fall in a big way. They kicked the the stool out from underneath him, right? Haman was hanged. If you follow the chronology of the Megillah, Haman was hanged on the second day Pesach. Mm-hmm. Right. In fact, in other words, to a large extent, the victory of Purim, La Yehudim Haisa Ara V'Simcha V'Sasar V'Kar, the Jews had light and happiness and glory and all of that. That pasuk refers to the second day of Pesach. That's again, The ultimate victory came about 11 months later when the Jews were victorious on the 13th of Adar against their enemies. But the first round in their victory was the second day Pesach, when Haman was hanged. Purim is the quintessential story of a miracle which is dressed up in the mundane and the ordinary. Right? That's the whole story of Purim. God's name isn't mentioned in the Megillah. God is working behind the scenes throughout the Megillah, but everything that happens, you know, could be pegged as palace intrigue. You know, they maneuvered this way, they maneuvered that way. Esther, again, you could say Esther and Mordecai were brilliant strategists. They knew how to work the system in an incredible way. Of course, B'nai B'ribono Shalom is behind everything, but it's the Esther Bonim. It's in a way which is hidden. God is, the miracle of Purim is a miracle of Teva. It's a miracle of the natural order, not a miracle of Nes, not something which is obviously supernatural. It's not by coincidence that Haman is hanged on the second day of Pesach, because that's what the day is all about. The Nes which comes about, you know, through Teva, through the natural order. Emelis, let's come back to the idea of Sfiras HaOmer. We started off the shiur asking, how is it that Sfiras HaOmer is linked to the Karban HaOmer? Why would the Torah say you can only count the days from Pesach till Shavuos once you bring the Karban HaOmer? And I think the answer philosophically is as follows. A Jew who can only appreciate God in the supernatural, in the realm of the supernatural, is not ready to receive the Torah. To be able to receive Torah, you have to be able to appreciate God's role in the mundane, in the simple, in every single aspect of life, you know, in the everyday occurrences that are part and parcel of the natural world. So how can we prepare for Shavuos by counting? We can only start preparing for Shavuos really after the Karban HaOmer. Because it's only the Karban HaOmer, that reminder of the fact that God plays such an integral role in the natural world, only the Karban HaOmer gives us the right to be able to receive the Torah to start preparing for Shavuos. That's the linkage between the two. That's why this whole period is called the Sfira of the Omer. Because what we're really trying to do during this period of time is to heighten our sensitivity and our appreciation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in everyday life. Torah is not about the miraculous, the once in a while. Torah addresses the mundane. You know, you talk to somebody outside of our camp, you know, you try to explain to them that we have a bracha in Yiddishkeit for when a person, you know, uses the restroom. They think you lost your mind. A bracha on the restroom? Well, what does one have to do with the other? But of course we understand that, you know, on the most basic of natural functions, we have an obligation to thank the Ribbono Shel Olam. Right? God is not just to be found in, you know, these spectacular, miraculous kinds of events. Kodesh Baruch Hu's presence is found everywhere, in every single aspect of nature which we experience. And, you know, and the notion of making a bracha on everything that we experience throughout life is reflective of that idea. We can, the beginnings of being able to appreciate that is the Karban HaOmer. That's why the Karban is so essential and lends its name to this entire period, and in fact is what makes Sfiras HaOmer De'oraisa, a Torah obligation, as opposed to being De'rabbanan. Without the Karban HaOmer, we don't have the vehicle to really express the fact that we recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, you know, in the minutia of everyday life of the natural world. I suggested in the past that this transition already takes place at the end of the Seder. What do I mean? Right, so the Seder obviously is all about, mostly about, thanking God for Yetzias Mitzrayim, these spectacular events. At the very end of the Seder, we switch over to Nishmas. We have the bracha of Nishmas Kol Chai Tevarech Hashimcha. Right, every living soul should praise you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, will bless your name. Nishmas is a bracha which thanks God Al Kol HaTovos Shosisei Mavoseinu Ve'imonu, for all of the wonderful things that you've done for us and for our forefathers. Not just the miraculous. Nishmas is thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the nisim that are every day, for recognizing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in everyday life. And to add, again, we've spoken about this in the past, but just to kind of bring this together, I think that's the real pshat in Chag Gadya. Mm-hmm. Everybody always wonders, like, goat, you know. Yeah, you know, I mean, again, you tell somebody who's unfamiliar with it, so what's the crescendo of the Seder? What's, you know, it all leads up. Well, we have this song at the end, we sing about a goat. A goat? Yeah, well, it's not just about a goat, it's about a cat, a dog, and a stick, and fire, and water, and an ox, and a sheichet, and the angel of death, and the Ribbono Shelom. Oh, now I get it. What? You know, that's how you end off the whole Seder, with a song about a goat? What is that? We've quoted in the past, you know, the Saradin historically did not sing Chag Gadyo. It was something that evolved in Ashkenazi circles. So there was once a certain Sfaradi was making fun of Ashkenazim. It only happened once. But a certain Sfaradi was making fun of the Ashkenazim. And he said, you know, these Ashkenazim, they're so crazy. They finish off the Seder, they sing a song about a goat. And he's going on, he's, you know, ranking out the Ashkenazim. A Sfaradi Chacham, a Sfaradi rabbi was present. And he said, Achutzpah, how can you insult your brethren, the Ashkenazim, this way? I hereby excommunicate you. So they went. They went to the Chidor, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, one of the great Sfaradi Chachamim, lived in the early 1700s. And they asked the Chidor, they said, you know, was this rabbi correct to put this man, you know, in Cherem, to excommunicate him? I mean, it seems like a little bit of an overreaction. Yeah, I mean, the truth is, and we do think those Ashkenazim are a little bit strange for singing Chag Gadol. Why would you sing a song about a goat at the end of the Seder? So the Chidor said, he was right to excommunicate the man, because indeed, although we don't sing it as Sfaradim, the song of Chag Gadyo is holy. If there's a tradition to sing it at the end of the Seder that the Ashkenazim have, it's obviously not for naught. It's something sacred, and God forbid that we should make fun of their customs. Not God forbid that we should make fun of their customs, because even if they don't make sense. No, it's holy, it's sacred, and, you know, maybe we don't do it, but, you know, it's not for naught that they sing about a goat. Okay, that's nice, but, okay, begs the question. So, why are we singing about a goat? So I think the answer is as follows. I think the answer really is, so there are many, many pshat and many interpretations. I think the simplest answer is as follows. Right, we've just finished the Seder, which is all about these, you know, as they say in Latin, these highfalutin things. You know, God took us out of Mitzrayim and he did all these, you know, miracles for us. Wow, you know, it's up there. Comes the end of the Seder and we say, Ribbono Shel Olam, we don't just see you when you take us out of Mitzrayim. We see you in the most mundane of human activities. Here's a goat. And, you know, the father bought a kid a goat for two zuzim. It's a mundane transaction. And here comes a cat and eats the goat. Who cares? It's a little, something that happened in an alleyway somewhere. Who cares? And a dog and a stick. And you look at all these things and you say they're trivial. That's precisely the point. HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be found at the end of the song, even when we're describing the most trivial things. You think life is just cats and dogs and goats and this kind of stuff. No, get to the end of the song, even there. HaKadosh Baruch Hu plays a role. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu plays a role in some, you know, back alley fight that's going on between dogs and cats and goats and sticks and all this kind of stuff, which you say it's silly, it's narish. Who cares about all of this stuff? No, but even there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence can be felt. How much more so? In all of the, you'll excuse me, the narishkeit of everyday life, all of the nonsense, which we think is being mundane and simple, whatnot, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can be found everywhere. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence is in every single thing that we do. That's the message of Chag Gadyo. You know, it's bedavka supposed to be silly and trivial and supposed to make you think, why are we singing this? Because at the end of the day, you see Hashem. So that's the lesson of the Seder. That's how the Seder ends off. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's why it's such a holy song. That's why the Chidor said, Chas V'Shalom, to make fun of the Ashkenazim who sing this song. Because if you can look at life the same way you look at Chag Gadyo, in other words, those things that seem to be mundane and trivial are really concealing the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the end. If you can recognize that, you're a holy Jew. You can really understand the world in a way which, you know, recognizes HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in a very real way. That's the end of the Seder. And that's the transition into the second day Pesach, which picks up on that theme with the Karban HaOmer. Chag Gadyo and the Karban HaOmer, in a sense, are stressing exactly the same idea. alibis. We continue going through the Sfiras HaOmer. It's an opportunity, hopefully, for us to look at the trivial, the mundane, the simple, and to recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is to be found in all of these things. Okay, wish everybody a good sphere. And we won't meet next week, but we'll meet the following week, Be'ezras Hashem, at 9.
At what time?
9 o'clock.